A few minutes after 9 o'clock on the following morning, April 9, Major General Edward King crawled into a jeep with three other men and rode north from his command post toward Japanese lines to confer with representatives of General Masaharu Homma. That morning, King had put on his last clean uniform so that he might look as dignified as possible under the circumstances. Gracious, mild-mannered, and taciturn, King was a career artilleryman with a law degree from the University of Georgia. A zealous student of Civil War history, King remarked that he felt as Lee must have felt before meeting with Grant, when the Confederate general had said, "I would rather die 1,000 deaths." Yet King understood that he had no choice. His troops were scattered and demoralized, many having resorted to looting food depots and hijacking supply trucks at gunpoint. "If I do not surrender to the Japanese," King said at the time, "Bataan will be known as the greatest slaughter in history. Already our hospital, which is filled to capacity and directly in the line of hostile approach, is within range of enemy light artillery. We have no further means of organized resistance." The Japanese aerial attack on Luzon had begun on the same day as the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th in Hawaii, December 8th across the international dateline in the Philippines. By a series of incomprehensible blunders and incredibly bad luck, the Japanese bombers and Zeros caught virtually the entire American Air Force of the Far East on the ground at Clark Field outside of Manila. In a matter of hours, the United States had lost control of the skies. For the first few days of the attack, Douglas MacArthur, who was then in command of the defense of the Philippines, lapsed into something of a fugue state. He stayed secreted inside his penthouse in the Manila Hotel, virtually unreachable and apparently unable to react. When he finally emerged, he somewhat reluctantly invoked a defensive strategy known as War Plan Orange that had been on the drawing boards for many years. The plan was executed brilliantly and with alacrity. Declaring Manila an open city, the outgunned Americans systematically withdrew from their positions around the capital and funneled down into the Bataan Peninsula to prepare for the onslaught of Homma's 14th Imperial Army. A few days before Christmas, Homma's troops landed at Lingayen Gulf and made their way south toward Manila, many thousands of them on bicycles. Encountering only weak and erratic resistance, Homma stormed into the undefended capital to find that the bulk of MacArthur's forces were already deeply entrenched on Bataan, which, with its roadless jungles and steep volcanic headlands jutting out into Manila Bay, was perfectly suited for a protracted defensive war. Bataan was perfectly suited, that is, as long as the trapped defenders could receive reinforcements of food and munitions from the outside world. War Plan Orange had always been predicated on the assumption that the army would have to hold out on Bataan only long enough for the Navy to steam across the Pacific Ocean and save the day. But of course, there was no Navy. The Pacific Fleet had been virtually destroyed at Pearl Harbor. Nearly from the outset, Bataan bore the markings of an American Thermopylae, a desperate act of heroic defense that seemed destined, ultimately, to fail. One Japanese officer likened the American predicament on Bataan to that of a cat entering a sack. The men were stranded on a finger of land, forced to fight on rations of less than 15 ounces a day, with rusty, antiquated equipment that dated back, in some cases, to the Spanish-American War. By Christmas of 1941, Washington had already come to regard Bataan as a lost cause. President Roosevelt had decided to concentrate American resources primarily in the European theater rather than attempt to fight an all-out war on two distant fronts. In a particularly chilly phrase that was later to become famous, War Secretary Henry Stimson had remarked, "There are times when men have to die." Still, during the 4 months of the siege, there were repeated intimations that food, ammunition, and medicines were on their way. President Roosevelt made a number of promises that he knew could never be kept, at one point pledging to the Philippine people by radio that every vessel available was en route to Luzon. Roosevelt wired MacArthur with the stirring report that every ship at our disposal is bringing to the Southwest Pacific the forces which will ultimately smash the invader. MacArthur was both a victim of Roosevelt's deceit and a purveyor of false hope himself. For he was inclined to view even the most guardedly worded cable from the War Department in an unrealistically sanguine light. MacArthur rightly felt betrayed by Washington. Yet at the same time, he burned with an optimism that bordered on the pathological. In March, when the situation grew truly desperate, President Roosevelt ordered MacArthur to leave his bunker on the island fortress of Corregidor in Manila Bay. With utmost stealth, the general and his family were evacuated by PT boat and then by airplane to Australia. Upon MacArthur's departure, General Jonathan Wainwright, a beloved, hard-drinking stick of a fellow universally known as Skinny, had crossed over from Bataan to assume command of the Philippines from Corregidor, and in turn, General Edward King had taken Wainwright's place as commander on Bataan for the final doomed weeks. Even as he assumed his thankless post, King knew that he would be the one who would have to surrender. He understood the inevitable tragedy of his position, one military historian would write, and bore his cross unflinchingly. What made surrendering doubly painful for General King was that he had no official consent to do so. In making what he called his ignominious decision, King had secured approval from no one in the high command, and in fact his superiors were adamantly opposed, or would have been opposed had he consulted them. MacArthur had expressly stated that Bataan was not to fold. From the safe remove of his offices in Melbourne, MacArthur had cabled Army Chief of Staff George C. Marshall that he was utterly opposed, under any circumstances or conditions, to the ultimate capitulation of this command. If it is to be destroyed, it should be upon the actual field of battle, taking full toll from the enemy. Skinny Wainwright was equally unyielding in his stated position on the matter. To President Roosevelt, Wainwright had pledged to keep our flag flying in the Philippines as long as an American soldier or an ounce of food and a round of ammunition remains. The moment Wainwright heard about King's decision to surrender that morning, he tried to contact him and countermand the move, but King proved unreachable by either telephone or radio. General King's unilateral decision to surrender on his men's behalf was thus courageous in several ways at once. He could only assume that he would be court-martialed after the war for acting contrary to orders. Yet he insisted on acting alone, so that no one above him, neither Wainwright nor MacArthur nor Marshall, would be saddled with any part of the responsibility. It was a soberly thought-out move, very much in keeping with the sacrificial nature of so much of the Bataan campaign. Since King could speak only for the forces on Bataan, Corregidor would still hold, at least for the time being, and Wainwright could decide for himself whether to surrender the citadel or languish until the last ounces of food and the last rounds of ammunition were expended. The 10,000 men on Corregidor had the supplies and morale to continue the fight. The Rock, as it was called, had been the target of a relentless aerial siege so massive that every tree and plant had been obliterated, leaving the surface of the island denuded and riddled with craters. But within the vast network of tunnels and catacombs below, the Corregidor forces enjoyed access to considerably more food, ammunition, and medicines than King's men did. Wainwright could hold out for perhaps a month. General King had another difficult problem to ponder as he motored north to meet the Japanese. He knew that a large percentage of his men were in such poor shape that they would be unable to walk to wherever the Japanese intended for them to go. As King put it in a memo, the physical condition of the command due to long siege, during which they had been on short rations, will make it very difficult to move them a great distance on foot. Foreseeing this eventuality, King had reserved a significant number of American troop-carrying vehicles and ample stores of gasoline expressly for the purpose of trucking the prisoners north to wherever the Japanese might designate. He recognized that it was highly unusual for a defeated general to request that the victors allow him to transport his own army into captivity, but he dearly hoped that General Homa would accept his proposal, for he feared that the Japanese did not possess sufficient numbers of vehicles to accomplish such a large task, and if they did, that they would find more pressing military uses for them. In spite of the white flags flying conspicuously from the two jeeps in King's entourage, his forward progress was almost immediately halted by several attacking Japanese planes. The aircraft dove low and proceeded to bomb and strafe the road, aiming straight for King's jeeps. Earlier in the morning, King had sent envoys ahead to alert the Japanese that he would be proceeding north to discuss terms for a surrender, and the Japanese had promised safe passage. But somehow the word had failed to spread to the pilots. Every few hundred yards, King and his entourage would have to leap from the vehicles and crouch in the roadside ditch to avoid being hit. The planes kept circling back to drop more bombs and pepper the road with machine gun fire. King's group crept northward, dodging the planes for more than an hour, until they spotted a Japanese reconnaissance aircraft banking over the road and tipping its wings in greeting. From that point on, they continued unmolested. Finally, they passed through the Japanese lines and were met by a soldier who politely escorted them to a farmhouse not far from the town of Lamao. They were shown to a table and chairs that had been arranged outside the house. Still rattled by the perilous jeep ride north, King sat down and tried to wipe some of the roadside dirt from his uniform. Presently, a black Cadillac pulled up to the house, and out climbed a short, grim-faced man, Colonel Motu Nakayama, General Homa's senior operations officer. Homa, who was back at his headquarters in Balanga, had declined to appear in person because he had assumed King to be merely a representative of General Wainwright and refused to conduct negotiations with a man of lower rank. From the start, Nakayama was greatly confused about the nature of General King's relationship to General Wainwright, and just what it was that King was offering to surrender. Nakayama took a dim view of King's notion that Bataan should be considered separately from Corregidor. Although geographically distinct, the two commands were militarily one and the same as far as the Japanese were concerned. "It is absolutely impossible for me to consider negotiations in any limited area," Nakayama curtly stated. In any case, Nakayama insisted that Wainwright had to be present before General Homa would entertain any serious discussions of surrender. Eventually, King prevailed upon Nakayama to hear him out and to agree, at least informally, to a cessation of hostilities. King raised his concerns about the condition of his men and expressed his firm hope that the American and Filipino troops would be treated in accordance with the terms of the Geneva Convention. He then requested that he be allowed to transport his men, under Japanese supervision, in U.S. Army trucks to wherever Homa desired. Nakayama categorically denied these requests. He made it clear that Homa would hear no terms or conditions from King, certainly not until Wainwright appeared at the table. When King reiterated his concern for the safety of his troops, Nakayama brusquely cut him off, saying, "The Imperial Japanese Army are not barbarians." When he received the news of the surrender, Edward Tommy Thomas had absolutely no idea what to do, where to go, how to comport himself. Surrender was not on the technical or emotional map of the U.S. Army, nor was it a subject that had been discussed in his training. The word was never even mentioned. Thomas was a lieutenant with the Signal Corps, and he had been spending the last week on Bataan with his field crew rigging up emergency phone lines across the jungle near the front. He was a loud, friendly giant of a man, a beaming 6'4" redhead from Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he'd been a star end on the Godwin High School football team. He'd had a difficult upbringing, even by comparison to the hard luck stories typically found in the Bataan Army. His father left his mother when he was a baby. His young brother had lost an arm in a trolley car accident and then died of scarlet fever, and during the depths of the Depression, his mother had sunk into a poverty so extreme that Thomas had to strike out on his own. He spent his last 2 years of high school camping out of a rattletrap car along Buck Creek, living off the meager proceeds of his paper route and his summer wages, tending lettuce in the region's famously peaty soil. He had wanted to go to college, but he couldn't afford it, so he joined the Army, which, in comparison to his life in Grand Rapids, seemed a radiant existence, holding out the promise of good money, $21 a month, and 3 hot meals a day. Surrender was never spoken of, Thomas said later. Never. Not even when we knew it was coming. We knew it was hopeless, that we'd been abandoned and were fighting a lost cause, but we still couldn't bring ourselves to plan for the inevitable day. To acknowledge the possibility of it was to admit weakness. Consequently, the defeated foot soldiers on Bataan had no protocol to follow. All across the peninsula, men were in the same throes of confusion that Thomas found himself in. Should they come out in ones and twos, straggling from the jungle with their hands up? Should they emerge onto the main roads a whole unit at a time? Or should officers make the initial overtures as representatives of enlisted men? Of greater uncertainty and more pressing concern was the question of what would happen to them once they gave themselves up. The men of Bataan had little inkling of what to expect. Like most Americans, Thomas was extremely fearful of what his captors would do with him. But at other times he visualized a bright scenario, based upon no particular evidence, in which the Japanese would ultimately give the Americans over to the Red Cross in a mass prisoner exchange. Never had the U.S. Army fought against an enemy about whom it knew so little. The initial encounter between victor and vanquished would involve an extreme clash of two proud cultures whose profound ignorance of one another predictably generated intense feelings of racial animus and mutual disdain. There was a sense in which the defeated Americans had become victims of their own blithely held notions of racial superiority. Before December 1941, many Americans stationed in and around Manila had scoffed at the Japanese threat, firmly believing that if war ever broke out, the conflict would be decided in a matter of days. Americans stereotypically portrayed the Japanese soldiers as buck-toothed, simian-like creatures who were neither clever enough nor well enough equipped to withstand a modern Western army. For his part, Thomas had never given a moment's thought to the Japanese, their background, their culture, their beliefs. Clearly, many stereotypes concerning the Japanese soldier had been wrong, but the Americans had little notion of what to replace them with. Said Thomas, "The Japanese were just the enemy. I had no idea what had happened when I finally met them face to face." Thomas spent the evening of April 9th hidden with his telephone maintenance crew in the cave-like folds of an immense tree just a few hundred feet from the main road, which was thronged with tattered American soldiers moving in great confusion toward Mariveles. The following morning, Thomas's Filipino crewmen decided to head north through the jungle and attempt to reunite with their families. Thomas wished them well and waved them off with tears in his eyes. Then he decided to go surrender himself. He slipped off his undershirt and tied it to a long branch that he'd stripped from the jungle underbrush. Slowly, he crept down to the road and started walking in the direction of Mariveles. Almost immediately, he spied a group of Japanese soldiers marching crisply in his direction. They wore khaki uniforms with combat packs, and their field hats, fashioned with long sun flaps in the rear, sported a single gold star. Bayonet blades gleamed brightly from the barrels of their 25-caliber rifles. Thomas hoped that as a telephone engineer with the Signal Corps, the Japanese would be inclined to treat him less harshly than if he were a fighting soldier from the front lines. With his heart pounding like a mallet in his chest, Thomas stood in the road waving his dingy undershirt. A jeep pulled up to him, and the Japanese driver motioned for him to hop in. In a few minutes they came to a Japanese camp, and Thomas was met by a young lieutenant who spoke nearly perfect English. He had studied at UCLA, he said, and he was fond of the United States. "Someday, after all this, I will go back." Then the lieutenant surprised Thomas. "Do you want to stay here with me and be my prisoner?" he asked. He pointed to a big white truck parked nearby and said he didn't know how to drive it. "Maybe you can?" So Thomas agreed to serve as the lieutenant's chauffeur. In return, the officer was kind to him and offered him cigarettes and ample food. You won't try to escape, will you? He asked. Thomas shook his head. Where would I go? He said. Good. I trust you. Thomas spent the next day driving the white truck for the Japanese lieutenant, tending to various logistical errands, hauling goods this way and that along the road. But after a few more days, Thomas yearned to be with his comrades. He gave the lieutenant driving lessons so he could fend for himself. Then they drove to a place not far from Mari Velis, where a group of nearly 50 American officers had been assembled behind a hastily strung fence of barbed wire. There was some confusion about where Thomas had come from, but eventually he crawled under the fence and joined the Americans. Thomas thanked the lieutenant for his many kindnesses and then said goodbye. Although he was the victor, Lieutenant General Masaharu Homma did not feel victorious, nor did he take pleasure in any of the usual glories or spoils. He was enormously relieved that Bataan had finally succumbed, but for the 14th Army, the war was far from over. Homma still had not won the true prize his superiors in Tokyo demanded of him, the prize which they insisted was long overdue. There was little point in occupying the Philippines if the Japanese Navy or Merchant Marine could not freely use the docks and wharves of Manila Bay, the finest natural harbor in Asia. Yet one could not control Manila Bay without controlling Corregidor. Fixed with cannons that could fire 20 miles, honeycombed with deep tunnels and lateral shafts, Corregidor was stuck like a steel bit in the mouth of Manila Bay. The island was shaped like a tadpole, its squirmy tail pointing off toward Manila, its bulbous head aimed at Bataan. The Rock, it was called, the impregnable fortress, the Asian Gibraltar. There was only one way for Homma to take Corregidor, and that was for him to move his forces into southern Bataan, array his artillery pieces high along the southern flanks of Mount Mari Velis, and rain unmerciful fire down upon the island, softening it up until an amphibious assault could be reasonably undertaken. Confronting this complex interlock of land and water, Homma realized that Bataan was but the first key. It is an axiom of Euclidean geometry that two points cannot occupy the same space, and therein lay Homa's problem. Before he could move his forces into southern Bataan, the surrendered Americans and Filipinos would have to be moved out. In their crippled thousands, they were underfoot, directly in the line of fire, like so much human debris. They were concentrated along the southeastern rim of the peninsula, precisely the area that afforded Homma the best vantage point for attacking Corregidor. Constantly chastised by Tokyo for moving too slowly, the ordinarily cautious Homma was under enormous pressure to expedite his artillery bombardment of the island. Thus, Wainwright's refusal to surrender Corregidor meant that the Bataan prisoners would have to be hastily cleared away, swept off the stage, in effect, so the next act could begin. General Homma had foreseen this enormous evacuation problem a month earlier, and had commissioned some of his ablest officers to address it. The officers had presented their ideas to Homma on March 28th. On paper, their plan appeared decent and humane. The prisoners were to be incarcerated at a place called Camp O'Donnell, a former training installation for the Philippine Army that lay approximately 75 miles north of Bataan's tip. The prisoners of war would be brought up the east road of Bataan. Those soldiers who were physically able would be expected to march, but the distances would be reasonable, on average no more than 10 miles a day. Food and shelter would be provided. Hundreds of vehicles would be furnished to transport the sick. Two field hospitals would be set up, each one capable of treating as many as 1,000 patients. The plan had two fatal flaws, however, flaws which would not become fully apparent until several days after the surrender. The first was that Homa's officers grossly underestimated the number of prisoners who would offer themselves up. Based on wildly inaccurate intelligence reports of enemy troop strengths made earlier in the siege, Homa's planners projected that only about 25,000 Filipino and American troops would surrender. The actual number, counting civilians, was closer to 100,000. The second major mistake made by Homa's planners was that they grossly overrated the health and strength of the prisoners. By their reckoning, well over 70% of the Luzon force could easily make the trip to Camp O'Donnell on foot. They had no sense of the scale of the starvation and disease that racked the Phil American troops. Overall, Homa seemed pleased with the plan. Although he was preoccupied with strategies for the coming offensive against Corregidor, it was important to him that the prisoners be handled fairly. Homa was a compassionate general, with views that might be described as liberal and internationalist. Considered by many the most brilliant military theoretician of his generation, Homa was a moody, sensitive, eccentric man of striking good looks. The son of middle-class landowners who had farmed rice for centuries, and standing nearly 6'2", he was regarded as a virtual giant for a Japanese man of his era. Homa's colleagues viewed him as fiercely intelligent, highly principled, and vaguely effeminate. A prominent novelist named Hidemi Kon, who knew Homa well, wrote that the imposing and large-statured general seemed like a man made for command. Yet he was a kind of living contradiction, with the personality of an idiosyncratic aesthete, unhappily trapped inside the confines of Bushido discipline. Homa was known for painting and composing verse during the heat of battle, a habit that won him the nickname the Poet General. It was a matter of some irony that General Homa should have been assigned to attack the American Philippines, for in both his philosophy and his personal style, Homa was democratic-minded and openly pro-Western, a public stance that had set him at odds with Hideki Tojo. General Homa spoke fluent English. He had traveled in America and was a great lover of American movies. He was a self-described Anglophile, having lived and studied for years at Oxford, and having traveled with British units throughout Europe and Asia. Openly critical of the fanatical ultranationalism that came to grip his country in the late 1930s, Homa had been a committed moderate in the years leading up to the war. In 1938, he had reportedly traveled to Nanking and authored a stinging document recounting the atrocities that had occurred under the Japanese occupation, a courageous stand that is said to have diminished his stature within the Japanese military. If Homa had a tragic weakness, it was that in his deeply introspective moments, of which there were many, he could be grossly inattentive to the details of his command, preferring to delegate all the messy responsibilities and minutiae to subordinates. A colleague once called him a paper genius, the sort of brilliant theorist who could instinctively grasp subtleties of strategy in the abstract, but who was slightly out of sync with the day-to-day realities of a fluid battle situation. The Poet General was a dreamer, an absent-minded optimist. If his intentions toward his new prisoners seemed compassionate, the question remained whether he would be steadfast and forceful enough to convey his compassion to the many officers and enlisted men in his vast army's lower echelons who would be charged with transporting the prisoners into captivity. On April 9th, as untold thousands of Americans and Filipinos stumbled out of the jungle sucking stalks of sugarcane and waving towels and bedsheets, Homa had buoyant confidence in the 14th Army's evacuation plan. Speaking in crystalline English that was accented with a certain Oxonian lilt, Homa told one captured American officer whom he met near his headquarters in Balanga, "Your worries are over. Japan treats her prisoners well. You may even see my country in cherry blossom time, and that is a beautiful sight." Crickets fiddled in the grass as the first rays of dawn seeped through the night fog. A rooster was crowing in a nearby barrio, and a breeze stirred from Lingayen Gulf, rattling the palm trees. At 4:30 in the morning of Sunday, January 28, 1945, it was still too dark to see. But the ranger encampment at Calasio bustled with life. Jeep engines revved, generators hummed, cauldrons clanged in the mess tents. The rangers were wide awake, dressed in their combat boots and jungle greens, sipping cups of Nescafe. Everybody had the jitters that morning. The collective adrenaline surge was palpable. Hardly anyone had slept. For many of the Rangers, this was their first true assignment, their first brush with combat. All their training, back in New Guinea, couldn't quite prepare them for the knot of emotions they felt now. The men were scared and thrilled in equal measure, touched by a kind of awe. Missions like this one were exceedingly rare. To go in and liberate a camp of doomed POWs was something extraordinary, a genuine prison break. And not just any prison, but a prison full of those guys, the men they'd read about in the papers or knew firsthand, their friends and cousins and older brothers. All those fate-fucked men whose boats left just before theirs was supposed to, who sailed on to this American colony halfway around the world to be sacrificed like goats. Captain Robert Prince had two such friends who'd been sent over to the Philippines ahead of him, close friends, men he'd trained with. They'd gotten trapped on Bataan and hadn't been heard from since. Prince wondered whether they were still languishing in Cabanatuan camp. "I didn't know if they were alive or dead, but I thought, maybe there's a chance," Prince recalled. Everyone knew that the men from Bataan had already suffered hardships that seemed beyond comprehension. So when Colonel Musi suggested that in all likelihood the Japanese planned to sweep these guys into a ditch and slaughter them, the Rangers were fired with a zealous outrage. "It made us so damn mad," Prince said. "We couldn't see straight." With this mission, the Army was operating on something like emotion, if the U.S. Army could be said to have emotion. The Rangers had to recognize that the sentimental allure of raiding Cabanatuan outweighed its strategic value. In the narrowest battle analysis, one could legitimately ask whether it was worth risking the lives of these elite young men in a romantic action that might be viewed as desperately ad hoc. What if the intelligence was wrong, and the Japanese weren't planning to massacre the POWs after all? In a full-out war, many armies wouldn't think of gambling so much on an emotional rescue. But that was a reckoning not one of the Rangers cared to make. The force of Musi's argument was irresistible. These men had to be liberated. The colonel made the endeavor sound so grand that to be part of it felt like the honor of a lifetime, a glorious entrustment. As Captain Prince's first sergeant Robert Anderson put it, "This was the most thrilling thing I had ever been a part of, and I'd have died before I would have missed it." Colonel Musi had proposed the sweetest imaginable use of force, to defend and avenge in the same act. At approximately 5 o'clock that morning, January 28th, 121 Rangers climbed into the canvas-topped beds of their GI trucks, and the convoy pulled out of Colosio, aiming east toward a ripening sun. At the head of the column, in a staff jeep, rode Colonel Musi, tobacco smoke pouring from his pipe, his Colt 45 tucked in a sidearm holster. Something about the colonel looked different, and it took a while for the men to figure out what it was. He'd shaved off his pencil mustache, the one he took such meticulous care of. "Too damn much trouble for this assignment," he told one of his men. Getting rid of it left Musi with one less thing to worry about. After a pit stop in Dagupan, the convoy headed southeast through the central plain. The men rode on a slender highway pitted by bombs and artillery shells, one of the main arteries that ultimately fed into Manila. They sped through flat sugar country, bordered on either side by jagged mountains, the Zambales off to the right, the Cordillera Central to the left. The Rangers tried to catnap in their trucks as the lazy vistas of Pangasinan province spooled past. Nipa shacks, cane fields, green volcanoes puncturing the morning mist. At this early hour, the road was empty, save for a few straggling refugees on Kalesa ponies, moving as fast as they could to get out of war's way. By the time the Rangers crossed the Agno River, it was already quite hot and humid, and the skies swarmed with American fighter planes. On the horizon, a half-dozen plumes of smoke curled toward the pink sky, targets still smoldering from the night's bombing runs. General Yamashita, it seemed, was giving up the central plain without much of a fight. The Japanese were running scared now, making a ragged retreat toward Baguio in the north, where Yamashita was now establishing his headquarters. The might of America was bearing down on them, the might of Pittsburgh and Detroit, the hardware of a new world hegemon, finally and fully aroused. Without the option of surrender, the Japanese army had no choice but to head for the terraced mountains and jungles of northern Luzon, some of the most impenetrable terrain in the Philippines, where upland tribes were said to hunt the occasional human head and kill wild boars with darts. Here, in these highland rainforests, Yamashita and his 250,000 depleted troops would hang on as long as their endurance and battle savvy would allow. For the Japanese, it would be Bataan in reverse, with the same sort of desperate battle logic the Americans had employed there. Extort every advantage from the geography, hang on past the point of starvation, and then await inevitable doom. Although Yamashita was conceding the central plain, he did not intend to let the retreat devolve into a rout. A large, well-coordinated withdrawal is perhaps the trickiest maneuver in battle. Every war college professor knows that it's virtually impossible for an army to defend itself well while moving backwards. Yet if any Japanese general was capable of executing this ungainly backpedal, it was Tomoyuki Yamashita, the unflinching commander dubbed the Tiger of Malaya, for his dazzlingly swift triumph over British forces in Singapore. Rather than throw up a massive line of defense across the central plain, Yamashita planned only to delay the inevitable American advance toward Manila, while protecting his own forces as they retreated along two north-south arteries, the Rizal and San Jose highways. To accomplish this task, Yamashita intended to concentrate troops in just a few places strategically situated along these major roads, so as to remain in control of his evacuation routes until the retreat to the northern mountains was completed. One of these strategic places was the provincial capital of Cabanatuan. With a population of 100,000, Cabanatuan, meaning a place of rocks, was the largest and most important town in Nueva Ecija province. The city was located just 4 miles west of the POW camp. Even now, as the convoy of rangers hurtled toward their designated jump-off point, more than 7,000 Japanese troops were massing at Cabanatuan City, with two more divisions on the way. Most of the Japanese were bivouacking in the city, but others were using the camp itself as a place to regroup for the night, sleeping in the empty barracks and dressing their wounds before returning to the front. The camp had become an enemy way station. The ranger convoy came to a halt at Gimba around 7:15 that morning. An agricultural outpost of a few thousand people in the somnolent rice country of northwestern Nueva Ecija province, Gimba sat on the edge of the American lines. For the rangers, it was the end of the road. From here, they'd be on foot for 30 miles, and then for 30 more, if all went well at Cabanatuan. A field radio would be set up if Musi needed to call the 6th Army for emergency help, but otherwise the rangers would observe strict radio silence, for it was feared and assumed that Japanese radio operators would be listening. The convoy stopped, and the men heard Colonel Musi yelling, "Everybody out!" Yawning, stretching, the rangers emerged from their trucks into the glare of a tropical morning. They were nervous as they stared out over the flats to the east. For a moment, they were gripped with doubt. The land appeared to go on forever. A steady heat shimmer rose off the rice fields, which were stippled with the remains of the harvest and framed in hard-packed dikes, perfectly square, block after block, stretching out as far as the eye could see. To the distant south, Mount Arayat, a vast solitary volcano, swelled almost 4,000 feet over the plain. The prison camp was out there in the no man's land, a barbed wire vision 30 miles off. The rangers faced a 12-hour march across roads patrolled by Japanese tanks, across Japanese-held bridges, across open country infested with Japanese pillboxes. Getting there sounded chancy, and getting there was the easy part. The return was what had them worried. How were they supposed to beat a retreat through enemy territory with 500 cripples in tow? What if the Japanese followed with tanks? What if just one village harbored just one spy? The men preferred not to dwell on all the things that could go wrong. They had to keep their minds fixed on the prisoners, let Musi and Prince sweat the details, and then pray for bucketfuls of luck. Surprise. That was the thing they had in their favor, the thing they must keep at all costs. The element of surprise. Invisibility right up until the moment. They had to cling to it, every second, every step. And yet, precious as it was, surprise was a funny sort of advantage. Fragile, future tense, perpetually subject to doubt, and so easy to lose. All it would take was a single Japanese scout with a good set of binocs looking in just the right place, or one Filipino quisling. Then, in a flash, it would be over, and the mission would go down as one of the war's great fiascos, a first-rate slaughter. The men lay down and tried to rest for a few hours in a grove of mango trees. Then, after a hot lunch, they selected a 2-day supply of K-rations, small cardboard boxes filled with a few canned goods, 2 cookies, several cigarettes, and a tiny roll of toilet paper. They were also given foil-wrapped bars of milk chocolate to present to the prisoners as a gift on their way out of Cabanatuan if the raid was successful. It was a nice touch after 3 long years in a death camp. Hershey's, the first beneficence of Uncle Sam. At 2 o'clock, Colonel Musi gave the signal, and the Rangers headed out on foot, marching eastward in a long single-file column with 2 young Filipino guerrillas as guides. Soon, the train of Rangers spread out over 100 yards, with Musi marching in the vanguard and Captain Prince bringing up the rear. They followed a road for about 10 minutes, and then, at a place called Consuelo, they turned south for several miles, cutting through an open field of dry grass. As the Rangers marched, American artillery shells would occasionally lob high over their heads and explode deep in Japanese territory, sending up magnificent clouds of dust. The Yank firepower was impressive, Musi thought, so impressive as to be worrisome. In fact, the colonel was almost as concerned about friendly fire as he was about any dangers posed by the Japanese. In the confusion of a porous and fast-moving front, there was the distinct possibility that forward units of the 6th Army could mistake the Rangers for Japanese troops, or, just as likely, that a single haphazardly aimed shell could fall in their midst. Theirs was a secret assignment, but it was secret in both directions. Except for General Kruger himself and his G2 people, hardly anyone in the 6th Army knew the Rangers were out here. Perhaps most troubling, no one had breathed a word about the Cabanatuan raid to the Air Force, which meant that there were Yank fighter pilots flying around above them, restless and trigger-happy pilots, who hadn't the vaguest idea what the Rangers were up to. As Musi and his men pressed farther into enemy territory, they began to realize, with an excitement cut with deepening dread, that they'd never been more vulnerable.